This is Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. On the program today, we have adaptations from two films. One is a musical film, White Christmas, music by Irving Berlin, and that's being put on by the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan. We'll have some members of the cast with us on the show today with some of the music. And also, It's a Wonderful Life, an adaptation by Willie Repoli, who will be my guest today from the Immediate Theater Project and the North Carolina Stage Company. They're bringing this production to the Dowden Fine Arts Center in Charleston this weekend. It's called It's a Wonderful Life, live from WVL Radio Theater. And that requires some explanation, which we will have in the first part of our show today. Our program today is made possible with support from the Danville Symphony Orchestra presenting At Home for Christmas this Saturday at 3:30 p.m. at the Danville High School Auditorium. Margaret Carlson presents her variations of Christmas favorites for the whole family. More information is available at 443-5300. That was a group called Tapestry, a duo, a husband and wife duo on harp and guitar and drums. And we heard The Minstrel Boy, their own setting, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Frost is cold.
Look, Joe. I want a big one.
On this portion of Live and Local, my guest is Willie Repoli, who is the producing director for the Immediate Theater Project in North Carolina. It's a program of the North Carolina Stage Company. And the two organizations are essentially collaborators on something called It's a Wonderful Life, live from WVL Radio Theater, which is coming to the Dowdna Fine Arts Center in Charleston this weekend for two performances.
So, yeah.
Saturday, 7 o'clock, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And Willie is the person who adapted this from directly from Frank Capra's screenplay?
That's right, yeah. I went back to the screenplay and sort of started from scratch. We had actually toured some years earlier with a different adaptation, which we liked and which was good, but it just never quite told the story that we really wanted to tell. So I went back to the original screenplay and sort of added in some scenes that we really missed, and I think helped make some connections clear between the characters, and also added in a story of the actors at WVL Radio who are performing this show and why they have to perform it under sort of unusual circumstances.
So what is WVL Radio, or where is this, hypothetically?
It can be anywhere. It has the advantage of not being, there's no location mentioned in the play anywhere. So it's up to the listener's imagination. If they want to put it in a big city, that's great. If they want to put it in a small town, that's terrific. If they want to put it in the town where they're seeing the performance, that's great too. And sometimes that happens because at some venues will even mention some businesses as show sponsors and work that into the show. And so it does sort of become part of the community of the people who are watching this play. And, I mean, one of the neat things about this adaptation, I think, is that the audience members are asked to play a role in the performance, which is the role of audience members, which sounds a little counterintuitive, or the opposite of counterintuitive, a little obvious, I guess. But it really is a distinct difference because the show conceit is that the show is, of course, being broadcast over the radio and being performed live for the people who are in the studio. And I think that helps give them a sort of personal connection, and I presume does help ground the show in the community where it's being presented.
So what gave you the idea to do the conceit of the radio program?
That was actually something that we didn't think of ourselves. There were several different radio version adaptations of It's a Wonderful Life out there, and somebody else at the theater actually had heard about it and said, why don't you look into doing one of these? And we did, and at first I was actually pretty resistant to the idea because I just didn't like, I don't know, something about the way the radio conceit worked as part of It's a Wonderful Life didn't sit quite right with me. But the story of It's a Wonderful Life was so good that we decided to go ahead and produce the show, and I was so glad that we did, because then it gave us the opportunity to figure out, well, what was that was bothering me in the first place, and we had the opportunity to go back from scratch and, you know, fix those things, and really make it the show, and really make the radio portion of it vital to the story of George Bailey, which I think is something that probably what I'm most glad has happened in this new adaptation, that there's a backstory with the actors at the radio station who normally would perform this show with a great big cast, 20 or 30 actors, and due to circumstances beyond their control are unable to do so tonight. And so there's a story within the play of the radio actors, and if the few people who have made it to the studio tonight can perform the show basically without the radio audience, who's ostensibly listening at home, catching on to the fact that there's only four actors performing this huge play. And so you kind of get the double story of George Bailey's story and the struggle of this radio station to stay afloat. Of course, the conceit is if they don't perform this, it's going to ruin the station. So you sort of have two stories of potential ruin that you're following simultaneously that hopefully resolve together in George Bailey's story.
So the radio adaptations you referred to earlier were in fact adaptations for radio, whereas this is kind of an adaptation of a radio show for the stage.
Well, there were several that were specifically intended for the stage, but at least some of those were based on an actual radio adaptation that from the Lux Radio Theater that Jimmy Stewart did, I presume as part of a promotion for the movie in 1947. I think the radio broadcast came out. And so some of the version that we used to do was based on that Lux radio show. So it was pretty neat. It had a nice nostalgic thing to it, but it didn't really connect with why it was important that it happened at a radio station and why it was important that it happened with only a few actors. So I hope that that's adds some richness to the new version.
So how much is there in this production beyond the It's a Wonderful Life story? In other words, when
it's
somebody goes
much.
To see it.
We really wanted to make sure that we focused on the story of It's a Wonderful Life, because really that's what people are there to say and to see. And the only way I wanted to intrude on that was in a way that really supported that story, in a way that sort of made characters and situations from that pop out even more. So we are introduced to the radio characters right off the bat, and within a few pages, because of course they're working against the clock, they've got to get this running before the broadcast starts, and so it really only takes a few pages to get into the story of George Bailey. And at some points you do watch both stories happening at the same time. For example, if you're watching George and Mr. Potter in the having a scene, somebody else is back there who has ostensibly never run a sound effects table before, trying to figure out how to make sound effects for whatever's happening, and that's a scene, a lighting a cigar, footsteps, door closing. And that was another thing we had to orchestrate really carefully, was when to sort of highlight that you were in on the secret and seeing something that you wouldn't normally see, and when to really focus on It's a Wonderful Life and not let the other story take over. Because at some point, it really does become George Bailey's story. Even with only four actors and a couple of sound effects, I really think there's the opportunity for the audience to be transported and forget all about the fact that this is a conceit and a play within a play, and it just becomes about George Bailey and hoping that things work out all right for him.
So does the technician in the background explain why in this clip we're about to hear, there's a little laughter following the sound effect of broken glass?
Because in order to make the sound effect of broken glass, we realized that if we have broken glass in a bag and hit it with a hammer, it creates glass dust. So we found some period-looking goggles, and it's actually a pretty funny effect when the actor during this scene puts on these goggles and hits it, and it's just one of those moments where the audience gets this little moment of delight, and of course that's how they did it, and it's so amazing to watch it happen in front of your eyes. And we often get a lot of laughter at things that certainly the movie didn't get laughs, but there's such a delight in seeing how that sound is made that people really enjoy that.
So here's a little bit of a scene between George and Mary from It's a Wonderful Life, live from WVL Radio Theater. Now you're playing George Bailey in the current production at North Carolina. Are you George in this clip?
Casts this year, and I'm playing George here at North Carolina, and there's another George here, and we've got a third George who's going out on tour.
Who will be at Charleston?
Right.
Are you the George in this clip?
I am. Yes.
Okay.
From a couple years ago.
And who's Mary?
I'm Lauren Fortuna, who is also the managing director of a media theater project.
Okay, here we go. Willie Ripley as George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life here on Live and Local.
What's your wish, George?
Well, not just one wish, a whole hatful, Mary. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world. Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. And then I'm coming back here and go to college to see what they know. Hey, what, are you going to throw a rock, too? Hey, that's pretty good. What'd you wish for, Mary?
Oh, no.
You want the moon. All you gotta do is just say the word now. I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Then what?
Then you could swallow it, and it all dissolves, see, and the moonbeams would shoot out of your fingers and toes and the ends of your hair and the... am I talking too much?
Yes! Let's go ahead and kiss her! Instead of talking her to death!
Hey, hold up!
Hey, youth! It's wasted on the wrong people!
Hey, mister! Hey, you come back out here and I'll show you some kissing that'll put hair back on your head!
A little bit from It's a Wonderful Life, live from WVL Radio Theater, George Bailey. And now, I sort of forget the sequence of the story. Is this Mary before she becomes George
Bailey? That's right. She's Mary, little Mary Hatch here. It's sort of the first date that Mary and George go on. It's an accidental date because they were at George's brother's high school dance, and they fell into the swimming pool as a result of a practical joke. So George does the gallant thing and walks Mary home, and that's a clip from that scene.
Willie Repoli as George Bailey, and Willie's my guest here on Live and Local. You can see It's a Wonderful Life in this radio theater production at the Downtown Fine Arts Center in Charleston this coming weekend, Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon, a co-project of the North Carolina Stage Company and Immediate Theater Project. You know, since I just said I couldn't quite remember the story at the beginning, let's assume there are some listeners who maybe have never seen It's a Wonderful Life on the screen or haven't seen it.
There are always a few.
Yeah, or haven't seen it in so long that they've forgotten the story. Give us a bit of the outline.
Well, very simply, it's a story of George Bailey, who is a very ambitious young man who wants to have an adventurous life, who wants to leave his little hometown, travel the world, and live this very romantic life. He's got a lot of, you know, wanderlust. And as the play progresses, he keeps making small sacrifices for the benefit of his friends and his family that slowly start to eat away at his dream of getting out of town. And eventually he is forced to take over his father's business. And it gets eventually so bad to the point where he is in very desperate straits and requires angelic intervention to help him see how worthwhile his life was by showing him what the world would be like without George Bailey in it. Well, that's actually a real, funnily enough, I just got a little choked up telling the story of his life. I think it really does touch people, that
as many
what it would be like if you had never done any of the things that you did, and so many of the people that loved you and relied on you would be in such dire circumstances.
And here's a line from the film, and I guess your adaptation. Strange, isn't it? Each man's life touches so many other lives. When he isn't around, he leaves an awful hole, doesn't he?
Yeah, we made sure we kept that line.
Yeah. Well, you know, that actually raises a question. In choosing to keep certain lines and certain scenes, and you said earlier that you put back some scenes that other adaptations had taken out.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the challenges in making these decisions?
Well, the biggest challenge really was not being able to include every line. I mean, it's a movie that's just full of great scenes and great lines, and if we did all of them, it would just be a little too long. So we had to pick our battles, and there are some scenes that we lost the scene. For example, there's a great scene where George is given a suitcase by his old boss, Mr. Gower, so that he can go on a trip around the world, and it's a great little scene, and we weren't able to keep it, but we did keep a few lines from it that were really key, I thought, to understanding George's motivations, and kind of work them into other scenes so that we still got the sense of that scene even if we weren't able to keep it. I think that's what we did all along, really, was try and find really what the core conflicts were and what the core relationships were, and let those really tell the story. And we did have to change a few things as well, of course, because it's radio, and anything that relied on sight had to be changed. Of course, there's a real audience in the room, so they can see the visual picture, but in order to make it feel like it really is an all-time radio show, we had to choose moments. It's sometimes very simple. Like, I think in the movie, George picks up a rock and throws it at an old house to break a window. Well, we had to add in a line that says, I'm going to throw a rock. Very simple. It's not obtrusive, but it just has to clear things up for the radio audience. So it's a combination of those things.
And what about the challenge of reducing what you expected in your version of the play to be a rather large cast, being produced by just four actors, which mm-hmm. then also is the challenge for anybody doing radio production. How do you make a play that was for a lot of actors to be done by just four players?
Sure. And there's definitely a lot of resistance at the top of the play when Lee is the man's name who runs sound usually at the shows, and it's his idea to go ahead and try and perform the show even with only four people. And he has to convince everybody to come on board, which is not an easy task because, you know, there's one guy who showed up. He normally plays one small part, Bert the cop, and he's not prepared to do anything else. The other woman who's there at the very top of the show isn't even an actress. She's the daughter of the station manager. But she has some public speaking experience. And so it really becomes apparent that these people don't know how to do all these voices and don't know how to make the sound effects and really don't want to. Until Lee manages to convince them that they at least have to try. And so then we get to also discover along with them new voices and new sounds and like, oh, I knew I was going to do Harry and George, and oh, as it looks, looks like I'm going to have to play Mr. Martini as well, and discovering these things in the moment so that for the radio audience, they don't hear anything out of the ordinary except a bunch of different voices from different characters. But the audience who's actually watching the play, the real audience, sees the actors making choices on the moment and choosing to play roles in certain ways, trying out different voices. It's one of those, you have the suspension of disbelief in this show, I think, which is always important in theater, but in this show, I think it's specifically about suspending the disbelief that this could never happen. Of course it couldn't. There's really no way that anybody could pull something off like this, except they do. So in this version of reality that people come to see, these people are capable of that, despite the odds. And I think people really enjoy rooting for them as they go through those struggles and try and figure out just how to make it happen.
So as George, as the actor who plays the actor who plays George Bailey,
that's right.
Who else does your character play?
I have the easiest track. They blame that on me being the playwright, but I play George and George's brother Harry. I play Martini, the bar owner, and I play Joseph, the head angel, who calls Clarence, the angel second class, in to be the one whose job it is to try and rescue George. So I've only got four. I think that's the least that anybody has. Most people have more like six or eight, and sometimes even 12 if you count people who come in for one line and then that's it. Well, a lot of time in crowd scenes, a character named, you know, Tom will pipe up for two lines and we never see him again in the rest of the play. But the actor has to come up with a new voice so that everybody knows it's not whoever Uncle Billy saying that line. It's a real challenge for the real actors as well as the radio show actors.
Well, I was just going to ask you.
In rehearsal.
I was just going to ask you, as the original actor or the real actor playing the actor, playing multiple roles, how do you manage that? Because you're playing an actor.
Right. Yeah. Well, I have the advantage of actually not playing an actor. My character Lee, who plays George, is the sound guy. He's not usually an actor. I think he'd like to be. I think he's sort of stuck doing tech because it pays more or something like that, you know. But he really wants to be on the air. So I have the advantage of knowing that he wants to show off his best self. He wants to be able to get a job on the air someday. So he really has to throw himself with all his might at this challenge. And he has to meet every challenge head on. He can't mess up at any point or... not only will the radio show fail, but he personally will not get what he wants. And it is a little bit hard to keep track of at first, but the more we rehearse them, the more we try out the different voices, a bigger challenge actually becomes, well, when does a voice come easily and when is it funny to watch someone discover a new voice? And again, that's a balance between whether the audience wants to see this play within a play or whether they want to see It's a Wonderful Life at any given moment, and how much give and take we have through that. So it's a delicate balance, but one that we worked hard to stay on the right side of.
Well, hopefully anybody listening to this interview will now want to go out and see both aspects, because it sounds pretty fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's a great challenge, and one that, I mean, again, is worth it because the story of It's a Wonderful Life is just so good. I think we forget about it. We think of it as this frothy holiday fair that's this tradition that you watch every year. And I mean, we forget that it's quite an involving story. I mean, we only care so much about George at the end because we watch him sacrifice over and over again all his hopes and his dreams, and until he's left with what he feels like is nothing. And we're so invested in his story and the brilliance of the Capra screenplay that we really get an emotional payoff at the end. And I hope the actors in the WVL radio actors also share in that payoff at the end, as of course the audience does too, because I think by casting them as the radio audience, they are invested in how it all turns out. And so it's a very cathartic moment for everyone there.
Well, if you're one of those folks who has been seeing It's a Wonderful Life every Christmas for 60 years or any part of those 60 years and want a different take on it, then consider going out to see It's a Wonderful Life live from WVL Radio Theater this weekend at the Dowden Fine Arts Center in Charleston on the Eastern Illinois University campus. There are two performances, Saturday evening at 7, Sunday afternoon at 2, and you can get more information on the Dowdna website. Go to eiu.edu/Dowdna, and you can see, as they say on their website, a small but intrepid band of employees managing to create the dozens of movie characters and scenes using just their voices and a sound effects table. At least that's the conceit. And my guest is Willie Repley, who plays George Bailey and these other folks, and Lee the sound man, and he's also a producing director for the Immediate Theater Project, who, along with North Carolina Stage Company, has created this adaptation. Really, Willie, thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Look, Daddy, teacher.
Okay.
Every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right.
Some music here played by pianist Rosemary Tuck, Auld Lang Syne, and The Last Rose of Summer. And we'll be going shortly to some of the cast members from the production at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan of the Irving Berlin musical White Christmas. We're actually at the moment trying to solve a keyboard problem. So I'm going to give you our calendar right now of other events that you can go see and hear live. The concert band at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston is giving a concert tonight at 7:30 in the Dowdna Fine Arts Center. Millikan University Children's Choir has a concert tonight, this evening at 5:30 at Kuiper Hall in Decatur. It's the play Almost Maine at the Station Theater in Urbana. That's at 8 o'clock and continues, Thursday through the rest of the weekend, also at 8 o'clock, all performances. University of Illinois Vocal Jazz Ensemble performs at the Krannert Center tonight at 7:30. The Traditional Jazz Orchestra is at the Iron Post in downtown Urbana tonight at 5 o'clock. The Pacifica Quartet performs the second part of their Shostakovich cycle tonight at 7:30 at the Krannert Center. University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra performs tomorrow night at 7:30, also at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. It's Music for a Season of Joy with the vocal ensemble Seraphim at First Baptist Church in Decatur tomorrow from 11:15 in the morning until about 1 in the afternoon. It's a Prairie Breeze's mini concert for kids with Celtic harp and dance at the Urbana Free Library tomorrow evening at 6:30. And that we will have some of those harpists on our show live tomorrow, so that will be a lot of fun. And the weekly traditional Irish music session at Bentley's Pub in downtown Champaign is tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock.
Nova, Nova, Ave.
Gabriel of Heidi
Nova, Nova, oh, oh, Nova, Nova, Ave fit ex eva, Nova, Nova, Ave fit ex eva.
Okay, that was music by the vocal ensemble Kalmus from Germany with Bob Chilcott's arrangement of a song, Nova Nova, for this holiday season. And coming up this very moment, we have four members of the cast of the Station Theater's, I'm getting my theaters mixed up, the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan's production of Irving Berlin's White Christmas. And I will let the executive director of the Little Theater, I was just looking at the calendar and gave things going on at the Station Theater, John Stevens, to introduce this show. Is this an adaptation of the film, or is this...
It is. It's what? Actually pretty close to the film. Everything that you'd see in the film, you'll see in this. But I think ours is better, you know, I have to say that.
On what grounds? In
no,
what
I'm
way?
Just, I'm just teasing. They're fantastic, though. I got to watch part of the run-through on Sunday evening, and they were just wonderful to watch. And the dancing is fantastic. Our artistic director, who's also directing and choreographing the show, Traylon Doler,
has done a great job with it. And casting the show, he's just done a magnificent job. So only one of the cast that is here with us today has been at the Little Theater before. Janie Wallace was here with us this last summer. But we've got three new smiling faces with us. And, of course, our resident man on the keyboard, Mr. Joshua Zecker-Ross, our music director, is back with us. And we're thrilled to have him back. It makes things go so much easier when we know Josh is around. So
when you say have him back,
he was with us this summer, and he came back and did Pete and Keeley for us, and now is back for White Christmas, and he'll be with us in the spring through next summer as well.
And our cast are Julie Zimmer in the role of Betty Haynes, originally played by Rosemary Clooney in the film, I presume. Mm-hmm. Kurt Olds in the Bing Crosby role of Bob Wallace.
Hello.
Janie Wallace, no relation to the original Bob, I guess.
No, but we do get confused a little bit on the rehearsal schedule.
Well, sort of like I get confused with which theater company are we talking about today. And apologies for that, particularly if I do it again. She's in the role of Judy Haynes, originally played by Vera Ellen. Mm-hmm. And what did you just tell me about Vera Ellen?
That the original Barbie doll was modeled after Vera Ellen.
So did she have like a 2-inch waist?
She did. She boasted the smallest waist in Hollywood in the 50s.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's something to boast about.
I don't think it was for her. I think she was pretty ill, but a stunning dancer and really terrific talent.
Oh, that kind of illness. We won't. Yeah. Craig Blake is in the role of Phil Davis.
You know it.
Originally played by Danny Kaye. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm trying to remember if I've seen the film White Christmas. I may or may not have.
I'm not going to lie. I had not seen it until we decided to pick it a year ago. So it was new to me as well. And everybody kept telling me, why have you not seen White Christmas?
Well, in that case, somebody else tell the story. Somebody who's actually seen the film and then maybe any deviations that they might expect from here. Bing, you want to
Sure.
it for us?
Yes. The story kind of follows, I think the magic to it is it really follows that time when Christmas became a big deal in America post-war, when everybody was coming back. And the story sort of unfolds at the end of the war. Those people familiar with the movie, it's I wouldn't say graphic, but it's a little more on the battlefield in the actual movie, with Danny Kaye's character saving Bing Crosby with a, you know, there's a fallen wall and he saves his life. And they sort of find out Bob Wallace, the character that Bing Crosby played, was a star before the war and then enlisted. And he meets the Danny Kaye role during the war. And they become a team, a performing team after they get back. They become very famous and they run into this sister team that Danny Kaye's character, Phil Davis, is sort of pushing. He has an interest in the young lady that is Judy Haynes here. And so therein lies the romantic ties between Phil and Judy and Bob, his friend, and Betty, the other sister. And they're on their way to Vermont for the Christmas holidays to perform. And Bob and Phil are on their way to Miami to go down and try out their brand new show that they're going to bring to television a little bit later. And everybody fools Bob and hauls it all up to Vermont, where they meet an old general of theirs from the war that is having a little problem with an inn that he has purchased up in the backwoods of Vermont. Mm-hmm. And there is no snow, and they're actually experiencing a heat wave, so they also have no customers. So they're unable to pay the Haynes sisters their fee. And I think Bob and Phil take pity on the general, and they said, hey, let's get that show, that hot show that we're going to be doing up here, and let's just try it out up in Vermont. So they bring everybody up there. And I won't give too much more away as far as the romance goes, but lo and behold, there is a white Christmas, and all the magic happens, and there's customers at the inn, and there's a big, beautiful show in the barn, and it just really conjures up all those feelings of that 1950s Christmas, early 50s, you know, after the war, as everybody was having babies and moving on with life, and America prospered.
Do I remember right that this film had a lot of similarities to the film Holiday Inn?
Yeah, and there are elements, musical elements, to Holiday Inn. Holiday Inn, the song, in fact, is in our show. And they follow White Christmas, but there are elements of Holiday Inn in there as well. So those people that know both movies, you'll feel them both. Their presence will be known.
And isn't White Christmas also in Holiday Inn?
Yeah, it was the song for Holiday Inn.
Yeah, that's sort of the irony of it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was this show, is this a new adaptation of the show, or has this,
it's pretty
the
recent.
Stage version been around for
years,
a while?
Yeah. Yeah. About 6 years old, the stage version.
And I think one of the differences between the stage version and the movie is that when they created the stage version of White Christmas, they took a couple other Irving Berlin songs that weren't in the movie and added them to the stage production, which they did very well. I don't think you would even know that they're from a different context, the way that they're in the show now. But there are a few extra songs and a few extra numbers that weren't in the movie.
Well, that's actually sort of typical of what they did in films and, for that matter, stage musicals at the time, which was to put in songs if they had some singer they wanted to showcase a little more. Well, I need another song, so they'd stick in another song, or they'd borrow back and mm-hmm. forth. And sometimes these songs wouldn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense in the context of the story. Does that happen here, or is it pretty much a continuous
They're
drama?
Integrated. It's very nice. And some of it, if for those people that are familiar with the movie, a lot of the music that was added was referred to in the movie. I mean, they don't sing Blue Skies, for instance, but it is mentioned in the film. They talk about it. Also, Love in the Weather from the show is some underscoring in a party scene. So, I mean, it sort of existed there. It just wasn't a big production number. So, you know, I don't know who's responsible for putting that collaboration together with, you know, with the stage version. But they did a really nice job of trying to find as much as they could in the movie and then, you know, adding what they needed. But Irving Berlin sticks together very well. I mean, he's a composer, I feel, that, you know, you can put together very tastefully in a collection, and he still has a string, a through line, a string of pearls, I should say, you know, I mean, that you can put together in different orders quite successfully.
So you're saying Blue Skies does show up in this film?
It does, yeah.
And we might as well let you guys sing, since that's partly why you came up. Mm-hmm. And Kurt, you and Julie have something together?
Yeah, I just mentioned it, actually, the song Love in the Weather.
Oh,
and it's really good. It takes place, you know, at the beginning of the show when when Bob and Betty haven't quite met yet. They're in two different locations, and they're talking about the way they integrated into the show is, you know, they're talking about their philosophy on love and how it's probably not for them. Little do they know what's ahead.
Of course. Loving the weather, we really are right now, aren't we?
Right.
Yeah.
So it's Kurt Olds in the role of Bob Wallace, Julie Zimmer in the role of Betty Haynes from Irving Berlin's White Christmas, which is opening on Friday at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan. And you're listening to them live on Live and Local.
Unpredictable, irresponsible, unbelievable, unreliable, ever since the world began, our Cupid and the weatherman. Love and the weather, birds of a feather, can't be depended upon. One day it's sunny, next day the sunshine is gone. Love and the weather, always together, planning another surprise, bringing the raindrops just like the tears to your eyes. Any guy with love close by is cozy and warm. Love walks out and kicks the guy right out of the warm into a storm. Moonlight romances have to take chances, that's what you learn with the dawn. Love and the weather can't be depended upon.
Love and the weather, birds of a feather, can't be depended upon. One day it's sunny, next day the sunshine is gone. Love and the weather, always together, planning another surprise, bringing the raindrops just like the tears to your eyes. Any gal who's Cupid's pal is cozy and warm. Love walks out and kicks the gal right out of the warm into a storm. Moonlight romances have to take chances. That's what you learn from the dawn. Love and the weather can't be depended upon.
Any guy with love close by is cozy and warm.
Love walks out and kicks the gal right out of the warm
into a storm. Moonlight advances, love's golden chances. Rain comes along and they're gone. Love and the weather change from night to dawn. Unpredictable,
irresponsible,
unbelievable,
unreliable.
Love and the weather cannot be depended upon.
Julie Zimmer and Kurt Olds from the film, from the stage version of the film, Irving Berlin's White Christmas. And that was fantastic. Does that song show up in the movie? Or is this one special?
No, like I said, it is referred to a little bit in some underscoring at a party scene. They're dancing to Love in the Weather, I think, aren't they? I believe that's the music at the inn when they first go to that first party.
It may be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nobody's real certain about that.
They don't sing it. Yeah. But
they do not. Well, fortunately, because for you guys, that they don't, because that gives a reason for people to go see this show.
Yes, exactly.
Or another reason to go see the show, because of course it's a classic, and we have the classic song, which I want to make sure that we have time to do.
Absolutely.
So why don't we do it?
Great.
And these are four members of the cast. Now we're joined. Julie and Kurt are joined by Janie and Craig. What is it with the J and K and J and K sounds here? Janie Wallace,
it's part
Craig
of the casting.
Blake. That was part of the idea. And our music director and pianist, Joshua Zecher Ross, from Irving Berlin's White Christmas, going to be at the Little Theater in the Square in Sullivan starting this weekend.
I the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas with every Christmas card I write. May your days be merry and bright.
Well, that's a beautiful blend between the four of you. Have you all worked together before? I mean, I know that just Janie has been at the Little Theater before, but have you worked together in shows?
Kurt actually directed me in a production of Cats how many years ago? 5 years ago. So yeah. I've known Kurt for a long time, but the first time I've been in a show with him.
Yeah, and she's worked with my little sister as well. Yeah. She's in the business. So there's lots of that's the wonderful thing about our business is, you know, you keep popping in and out of people's lives. And the artistic director of Little Theater is, as John mentioned, Traylon Doler. And I had an involvement with Traylon back when he was just a little kid at a performing arts camp. I was actually his theater counselor. So, like, I mean, I've known Traylon forever, and that was one of my introductions to this particular theater. And, you know, we just have friendships that go back and forth. And, like, Craig and I haven't worked together, but, you know, there's...
We know a million people.
Exactly. And there's a very good chance we'll end up at somewhere else together. And Julie, we've known each other as friends for a while. We've never worked together, but it's a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. And are you all acquaintances of Traylon? Did you get picked for the show or audition?
Yeah, Traylon brought all of us in for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've worked with Traylon a couple times before in the past as well. So it's great to work with him. Especially in this show at this time of year, it's great to have a cast of people who, although we've never met each other, it kind of feels like one big family there. So
yeah,
it's great.
And Traylon, you know, he does a lot of wonderful things, but above and beyond, shows like this are sort of more in his blood than any, I think. He just, you know, it's he's such a gifted choreographer and just a showman. He gives a really polished look to a show, and White Christmas is exactly in his vein of expertise.
Absolutely.
But he does just about anything pretty dang well.
How often are stage directors and choreographers combined? I mean, I'm thinking of Bob Fosse.
More and more lately. But it is a special talent. I mean, it's not something that's common, although you do see a lot of them these days. It takes a very special person that can direct and choreograph. It's just a massive job load. You know, it's doing two people's jobs.
Traylon directs across the board, whereas he can go direct a straight play and then pop right into a musical and do all the choreography and direct it and not skip a beat. So he is a very talented fellow.
I think also in a show like this, you see storytelling through the dance with a director-choreographer like Traylon. I think that's something that you may not see in other productions like this, is such a clear sense of story within the dancing. And I think it's way more exciting to watch as an audience member.
What's the size of the cast behind you four leads?
22, I think, is the full count.
19.
Just kidding, 19.
Yeah, 19 in the cast. 18 adults and one, how old is she, 10 or 11?
10.
Yeah.
10-year-old.
She's great.
How does she get snuck in there?
She's fantastic. She's one of the students from our dance and drama program, and we needed a little girl in it, and she is just spot on for it.
Yeah.
She's really cute.
Yeah.
Well, cute is always important.
Yeah, she's cute. And she's
very
fantastic
actress
too. She really is spot on.
Yeah, a nice bonus when you can combine cute with actual talent.
Yeah,
and we have a big scene I have with Allie. What's Allie's last name?
Easton.
Yeah, she plays the character of Susan, and we have a nice moment on the front porch where we sing the classic "Counting Your Blessings" that Bing and Rosemary Clooney both recorded. But she was giving me some notes on lines and such. So she's very experienced.
So she'll be directing you someday.
Someday, yeah. We hope. I have no doubt. Yes, yeah, she's very, very talented.
Maybe even in the next few years, it sounds
yeah.
like. Yeah. How many prodigy directors do we have? She could be one. Well, I'm thankful you're all able to come on the show. I I'm sorry we got slightly shortchanged in time, having a little trouble with her keyboard, but we're also very grateful that the hum did not return, and so we were actually able to do it. White Christmas opens on Friday at 8 o'clock at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, and performances on Saturday at 2 and 8, Sunday at 2, and then additional performances the 15th through the 19th. For more information, you can go to thelittletheater.org and see info on this show and also the many other productions that go on there. And not only productions, but, John, you alluded to other programs as well. John Stevens is the executive director, Joshua Zecker Ross, music director and our pianist, Julie Zimmer, Kurt Olds, Janie Wallace, and Craig Blake for the cast. Thanks all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our broadcast today is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign. This is Illinois Public Media, WYNL-FM, and HD1 and HD2 Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.